Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Accounts of post-war art have, until now, positioned Virginia Dwan as a figure of the late 1960s, focusing on her New York gallery through 1971 and her extramural projects thereafter. But this slant tends to leave Dwan's carte blanche leadership unexplained, offering no sense of it as something achieved after a lengthy honing of instincts or as a process that began well before her East Coast chapter. What Dwan offered to her artists, the celebrated attitude of latitude, the many manifestations of so-called negative space, did not come from nowhere, not exactly. For the public symposium held on November 19, 2016, in conjunction with the exhibition Los Angeles to New York, Dwan Gallery, 1959 to 1971, at the National Gallery of Art, Julia Robinson argues that the challenges of late 50s Los Angeles, far from the international art world, galvanized Dwan Gallery's founding years and its outre stance.
So most accounts of post-war art up until now have focused on the Virginia Dwan of the late 1960s, her New York gallery through 71, and her extramural projects thereafter. But this angle, I would suggest, tends to leave her celebrated carte blanche leadership unexplained. We have no sense of this as something achieved after a lengthy honing of instincts, or as a process that began well before the New York chapter. What Dwan offered to her artists, that famous attitude of latitude, that so-called negative space, did not come from nowhere. Not exactly. As I will argue this morning, it was the unique situation of late 50s Los Angeles, far from the international art world, and the challenges of the Dwan's actual founding years, the Dwan Gallery's founding years, that galvanized its outre stance. As Dwan learned from scratch how to navigate her chosen field, how to negotiate and collaborate with the artists she sought out, both Americans and Europeans, she laid the foundations for a remarkable decade of exhibitions. Perhaps not coincidentally, this happened in alignment geographically and chronologically with the founding of Art Forum, the magazine that was sort of the only player as far as I would argue in this period and for the next many years, but starting in this moment. So Art News and Art in America had been going for a very long time, and suddenly 1962 Art Forum pops up and really follows a similar trajectory to Dwan's own moves. So as striking show announcements appeared in the pages of Art Forum, that magazine assumed the leading role in the critical reception of advanced contemporary art, and particularly, as it happens, this art. So both entities changed coasts within a few years. Art Forum following along literally in the same sort of segments as Dwan. So they moved from their ramshackle headquarters in San Francisco in 1962 to LA, just as Dwan opens her new space. When Dwan starts a second gallery in New York in 65, she then closes up shop in Los Angeles in 67, and Art Forum leaves Los Angeles and comes to New York. So they have these sort of similar trajectories, but what I would say is the West had proven a robust testing ground for both entities. For Dwan, it had been the ultimate anteroom, not only to New York, but to the vast and heretofore unfathomable venues that certain of her artists had resolutely in their sights. So in 1958, a young Virginia Dwan was working occasionally at the Frank Perls Gallery in Los Angeles, as Pam mentioned yesterday. And this time she began to envisage the gallery that she wanted to start herself. A seasoned New York dealer, Perls had told her that this was probably going to be a losing enterprise. Most dealers of the 40s and 50s would have conceded, in fact, that they would have folded many times if not for a very few life-saving collectors. And most of them, New York we're talking as well, barely broke even. So at the time, just to give you a little context, at the time of Dwan's apprenticeship in 59, and she opens this first gallery in this very year, the main New York galleries showing current art, most of which had opened relatively recently, included Betty Parsons, which was established in 46, Sidney Janis, established 48, Tibor Denodge, 1950, Martha Jackson, established 53, Alexander Iolas, 55, and Leo Castelli, 57. In Los Angeles, there was Everett Ellen and a few others, and a relatively new arrival, the Ferris Gallery, which was launched in that city the same year as Castelli in New York. Although Ferris was its polar opposite, Castelli's, in every sense, and that very much plays into our story. Leo Castelli was a cosmopolitan Italian who had previously owned a gallery in Paris and drew upon a large network of European contacts. Castelli Gallery, as a result, was the model of internationalism and sophistication. Ferris, by contrast, was local and casual, directed almost co-op style in its founding years by Ed Kienholz and art historian Walter Hopps, and eventually businessman Irving Blum. It boasted a sizable cohort of around 40 to 50 artists, and essentially was kind of like a boys' club of macho motorcycle riding Californians. So joining this fray in 59, Dwan is obviously going to play a rather interesting role, even if for most of this early period her personal presence was understated. One of these reasons is because her name was Kondratiev, and she kept that on all her stationery and everything, so it was Dwan Gallery on the street and a much more subtle presence, a less assertive presence in all the business of the gallery. So the first Dwan Gallery opened for business in October 59. A storefront located on Broxton Avenue in Westwood, it was a fair, perhaps comfortable, distance from Ferris. The entrance was flanked with glass showcases, as you're seeing. Oh, you're not seeing, actually, you'll see those in a couple of slides. Oh, wait, maybe I'll move that on. What have I got next? Wait. I'm just going to stay with that one for a sec. Just imagine glass showcases. You saw them yesterday, actually, I think. So there, you imagine this sort of commercial storefront. The inside space wasn't large. It was about 50 feet deep by 22 feet wide. And there was this sort of track lighting, as you can see, with fairly intrusive sconces lining the ceiling. Anathema today, we forget that this was fairly typical of the 1950s, just like picture rail hanging devices for painting. In the center of the main space, there were these modernist wood design benches. In the beginning, they had plump cushions neatly placed so the visitor can sort of crash and take a breath because they have to come off the beach and look at works of art. So they were sort of answering visitors' needs like a good host. If the simple, elegant benches were the right impulse, the cushions were a little homey. It would take a while for all of that, of course, to be synced up with the ideals of an emergent gallery. At the far end of the space, there was a white filigree metal screen, which notionally sort of divided off the business of the gallery, the office area, from where the work was shown, and where Dwan and her colleague Eugenie Thompson was sort of lingering to keep an eye on things. A final signifier in this early moment as well was, I don't know if you can see it, oh yes you can, the painted lettering on the front window. Which gave the gallery hours. And it sort of hinted at the earnestness of the enterprise, I think, in this moment, announcing that the gallery was open daily, excluding Sundays, so no by appointment in this case. So the Dwan galleries, I'm trying to sort of take these signs or sort of measures of how the gallery changed and how I interpret those changes to be Virginia Dwan's own learning and working out what was going to be expected of her and how to end up with the incredibly sophisticated, beautiful, extraordinary gallery and operation that she would have within a few years. So I'm sort of peeling it back to the incremental signs. So the changing details in the first several over the first several installations strike me as subtly conveying this learning process. So we can see this even quite simply just going on the photographic record. Dwan, at this time as ever, gave the artist free rein, fairly free rein. And on the whole, she was sort of able to trust them, as she always did, presuming they'd know how best to arrange their work. And in fact, I think watching, almost deferring at this, you know, tender stage to their years of experience, which most of the first artists she had been exhibiting for quite a while. On the other hand, we still can't fail to notice the non-art details that are, you know, a little bit distracting. They're seemingly trifling things like furnishings, but once they get changed, they prove anything but trifling. So Dwan picked herself up on quite a few rookie errors, overcompensating, overdecorating, overthinking, and progressively corrected them. At the same time, it seems that a certain zeal on a part of some of her artists resulted in them making their own mistakes. So this just amuses me, this like hand-painted big scribbly sign for Goodnow. And it's so that's the detail I wanted to see there. This plant is kind of funny in this one. This is the Klein installation that just shows you this sort of office area divided back office space. So let's see. So the artist making their own mistake. This glaring detail of Robert Goodnow's installation in May 1960 is a quaint but obtrusive sign that's propped in the middle of the show. In an otherwise spare space, a board pitched on an easel and hand-painted with the artist's name, and which is the show's title, seems to give a kind of strange personal touch / signature / sense of authenticity. And authenticity was sort of a big 50s thing, and it was a big difference between the 50s generation and the 60s. So this sort of name imprimatur element that now looks a little naive on the part of the artist. So in retrospect, this clash between an artistic sensibility and the gallery would be a harbinger for bigger schisms that would happen with Dwan and her first kind of array of shows. But we'll see how that unfolds. So what appear to us today is quaint, even sort of tawdry interventions, gilding the lily, as they say, were actually common in the 1950s on the part of galleries as much as artists. Indeed, Dwan's few decisions, restoring the modernist lines of the benches by removing the cushions, ditching the busy and sizable planter that was in the front and centre in the space, were not that obvious as things went. As a regular visitor to New York, she would have known this very well. So what I'm showing you here, and I'll get back to the expert. So Sydney Janus, it's a show that I've sort of been concentrating on a lot, but I can never get around the fact that the catalogs hung on the wall in between the Warhol and the Armand, and this like fairground sort of sign here, and then the lovely big plant in the corner in competing with the paintings. The storefront windows is sort of interesting issue too, because Dwan, her big move is to get rid of the storefront window, right? In the second space, you'll see, so it's covered up. Janus actually hired an extra one to sort of make it look more poppy and just for this new realist show. So his gallery was upstairs and he hired a street, 57th Street entrance. So there's this sort of interesting reversal that goes on. Interestingly enough, also Betty Parsons weighed in on this the two women seem to have the smartest takes in a way. Betty Parsons insisted on white walls for abstract expressionist art, whereas, and Ad Reinhardt and all the figures that she showed, whereas Sidney Janus was into grey walls because he had this idea that it was sort of more between a gallery and a home, and it may make people imagine that they have this art in their home. So it was a commercial idea. There are a number of calculated decisions on Janice's side, and in fact, in the end, Oldenburg makes a parody of that with this sort of his first tableau. I'll get to that by the end of the lecture, but he does a three, installation piece where he has Janice's grey walls and his office and his Venetian blinds in the piece. And the piece now lives in another museum with Janice's imprint still there, won't get too critical to start off with. So there's all these sort of details that are surprising to us now. Freestanding ashtrays, plants, flowers, around the paintings, making it look like a little altar or something. So it's hard to think past the slick contemporary galleries that we've become so familiar with in recent decades, after years and years of refinement. Castelli was prone to some of this. Janice, maybe, an older gallery more so. So anyway, this sort of brings me to the question of Dwan's early shows and artists. And I'm sorry if any of these are sort of, some of them are different qualities. Yesterday I was shocked how big this screen was, so it's sort of a little tough on the images. But anyway, I hope that you can see them all. One issue I want to sort of raise as a subtext to the shows in the first years of Dwan and the gallery space is another superficial but not superficial element, which is design, graphic design, and the way that the Dwan Gallery gained its stature, status, seriousness and weight in the art world by progressively refining how it looked in magazines, posters, invitations, and so on. So this is a sort of a cluster of some of the first invitations and things. Now, very bad images, but it's important. The point is far more important, more significant than the image. So down the bottom, you see what was on these flyers. Goodnow, Hartigan and Richenberg in cooperation with Thibaut Denoge, Bontecue, Chamberlain, Higgins, Leo Castelli, right? So that's sort of the backdrop to now what I'm going to talk about for a moment. So to start off with, Dwan contacted the New York galleries to identify art for her exhibitions, starting from absolutely from scratch. So this would prove to be another learning experience. The correspondence in her archive now shows her forming new relationships and really making the best out of, quite a difficult geographical situation. Through regular trips to Europe, she consolidated contacts and also honed her own interests. The initial schedule comprises shows, first of all, with painters of medium note, Stanley Tarkovitz, Mike Kanemitsu, Seymour Boardman, and some resourceful group shows in between. One other juxtaposition this throws up, Seymour Boardman was one of Martha Jackson's artists, and the contrast between Jackson and Dwan is also fabulous and fascinating. So basically, Jackson was really stayed with the things that Dwan had for like 6 months. So she was really second tier abex for a very long time. And I sort of came to Jackson through the wrong end of the telescope in the sense of this new forms, new media show that she did, two of them in 1960, and then Environment, Situation, Spaces in 61. And what you realize is that it's sort of John Weber, Ivan Karp, all these other people who are around Jackson that made those shows happen. And the rest, they're complete anomalies. And actually, John Weber, even more amusingly, if you go to Jackson's archive in Buffalo, there's a memo, and he's like, "You've really got to show this guy Andy Warhol. He doesn't have a gallery." And she's like, "Absolutely not." And so he was dealing Warhols out of her office without permission and got fired. And then Kanemitsu, who gets very furious that Dwan's even starting to do what she's doing, says, I understand that, you know, Weber's coming to you and Martha's very happy to see him go and all this. It's a sort of a very amusing dynamic. Well, I'll keep going. So the run of painting shows start to sort of thin out, and as the gallery began to sort of indicate an interest in new directions. And long before Dwan's given storefront, in contrast to Janice's rented one, before all this change happened, that even the storefront sparked interests by some of, on the part of some very forward-thinking artists. So what I'm trying to point to is something that James has brought up in his essay, that Larry Rivers, I mean, I've never been a huge fan of Larry Rivers, but he has this, he occupies this really sparky place between abstract expressionism and pop. And Dwan happened to show him at that very moment when the gallery was making that transition and people's thinking was and everything. So in 1961, Dwan's storefront in the original gallery became the vehicle for recoding the message in a way sent by a good-nosed Gordy sign the previous year, exacerbating or desublimating the intent of the older artist, this authentic intent. Rivers painted out the showcases in order to herald his February exhibition. So this is, for the time, I think, a rather hip address to painting. It also turned out, merged with the ad, which you see in the galleries and on the left here, as a sort of concept, all over concept. Rivers's act seemed to tap the zeitgeist, fusing the skilled expressive gestures of the painter with the haphazard functional ones of the handyman contractor, who whites out the pane of glass to transport it. So if you think of that Baguette Austerlitz of Duchamp, the whited out glass, we might say that Rivers is already a learned post-Duchampian, but now redefining his action slash painting by signing his show. So it's no longer a sign in the middle of the space, it's an entire show. So after the first year, Dwan's diverse efforts to stake out a position begin to generate results. She goes to New York, and by this time she's already met quite a few of the abstract expressionists. Rivers is introduced to several figures. She's going to the Cedar Bar, which I always thought was very gutsy, brave, given that it was all male and bloodbaths over painting. So for a young new dealer to go there and sort of brave that place is quite incredible today. Dwan had already expressed her commitment to certain artists by buying their work to sort of think things through, even as she was, for herself, even as she was sort of working out how to be a dealer. So she had done this with Philip Guston, purchasing some of his work from Janice. And then, therefore, when she approached him about a show in LA, he was receptive. And not only that, he took her to meet Franz Klein, who had won this medal at the Venice Biennale the year before, and Dwan happened to be at that Biennale as well. So she was in a very interesting, rare position that not many people occupied all those spaces and places. So the gallery ultimately mounts a two-person exhibition. Dwan's ideal had been to create two solo shows, one Klein, one Guston, had the work been available and been possible to get it all to LA. But already doing this in Los Angeles was a startling feat. It was a first for the gallery and a rare event for LA, even if the public reception didn't quite reflect that. So on a trip to Paris in 1960, Dwan discovers the work of Yves Klein, chancing upon a painting, sponge painting in the window of Galerie Rive Droite. She enters and proposes that Klein should have an exhibition in the United States, speaking to the gallery director, Jean Lacard. As it happened, Leo Castelli had been there 2 weeks before and had the same idea. So the plan was made for an exhibition, a version of the present exhibition, Yves Le Monochrome, Which was up in Paris from October 11 till November 13, 1960, to travel to Castelli and then to Douarn in early 61. Douarn was impressed to find, as she started to deal with Castelli, a seasoned counterpart who was very forthcoming to doing a collaboration. His business acumen, a mix of pragmatism and elegance, couldn't help but be instructive for her. So it's therefore particularly interesting to consider then the stark differences between what Castelli did and what Douarn did with Yves Klein. So the two American venues were sort of a world away, even though the critical reception was not that far apart. He had a difficult reception, let's say, Klein. So the shows were April 11 to 29 at Castelli and May 29 to June 24, 61 at Douarn. From the diverse group of works shipped from France, Castelli devised a pure, univocal statement, narrowing the show down to a series of rectangular blue monochromes. Elegantly arranged and exquisitely lit, they took on a hieratic charge in his 77th Street space. Castelli's decision, of course, to distill the work into a formal and chromatic coherence, exercising the style and business sense of not too many ideas, obviously came from years, if not decades, of experience. On the other hand, Douarn got to know Klein himself and decided to take the opposite tack. What I'm showing you is just a kind of a goofy comparison between why it was interesting to invite Klein to LA and why he loved it, and his own background. So, this is sort of where Klein's born, where he grows up with Armand and Marcel Reiss. Castelli had him in the Chelsea Hotel in New York, and suddenly he comes to LA and says, wow, you know, so a whole lot of different things ensue because of that situation. So embracing, I think Douarn really embraced the artist's sort of persona and project and sort of encouraged him to make a big range of works for the LA show. What's interesting is, so Castelli, the idea is that Castelli got a lot of work shipped from Paris. He got fire paintings, anthropometries, rose monochromes, gold monochromes, all these things, and he just showed the blue, right? And essentially there was this sort of back room where he had a few other works, and there's a story, and I haven't been able to verify it, but you know, I know that a lot of American artists couldn't stand Klein, but apparently Rauschenberg and John said they'd leave the gallery if he sold one work, Castelli. So there's a lot of... And Klein's great dream was to meet Rothko, and Rothko was like, absolutely not. So, you know, so Castelli sort of neatened up the picture, let's say. So instead, though, Douarn sort of does this opposite thing. The array of works in the show is also a result of, how it came into being. So this idea that he came to Los Angeles, he had this monochrome exhibition which had expressed in many ways already, and then he sort of, works on the shore making all these sort of new versions of what he'd done. One thing I'll say is that, when we think about, it's not... we talked about yesterday getting out of general gender stereotypes with the Smithson and Holt. We don't want to say a woman lets everything happen and a man lets nothing happen, or focus, unfocus, or whatever. Klein himself had defined his monochrome definition and proposition already in Paris some years earlier. In 1957, he had five shows, and they were all of in Italy, Milan in January, Proposto Monocreme in London, two in Paris, and one in Dusseldorf in Galerie Schmeller, right? So he had defined the hell out of this monochrome idea, and some of the shows were gorgeous, all blue monochromes, and others weren't. What I'm sort of suggesting is the performativity of Klein defining his own work slips into the performativity of Castelli, saying this is a strange artist coming here and I'm going to show you its abstraction as usual, right? So there's this sort of interesting thing about Dealers and perhaps Dwan and what she did with Yves Klein shows us that in a way that we might not have been able to see it otherwise. Actually, so feels sacrilegious, doesn't it, going from Klein to Reinhardt. So just to sort of end that idea, the intensity of the single Klein painting that prompted Dwan, prompted her exuberant reaction in Paris originally, was somehow played out, even amplified through his activity, their activity in Los Angeles. So the monochrome proposition had been endlessly generative since its invention, but now Dwan's instinct and the situation that she made possible to create a radically different constellation of works from those that had been seen just 1 month before in New York extended the logic of immediacy in Klein's art and also imbued this show with a vibrant contemporaneity. So sort of a rare and interesting combination. I just mentioned that both of Klein's American shows were negatively received, even the opposing installation decisions. And that in itself bears some scrutiny, but we don't have time for that now, but it's just like hopefully we can start talking about it in the discussion. So just this initial Castelli relationship that Dwan had created here, I would say that Dwan would learn from Castelli in that early moment, but she had no real need to mimic him. Not that she would have, but she didn't really have a need to, right? So their radically different situations would have obviated such an idea. What the Klein Project provided at this early moment, like on the ground in terms of on the record factually, is a not only a positive reinforcement, but a sense that Castelli trusted her and the Dwan Gallery as a viable commercial partner. And eventually it translated into the gallery itself, this fledgling gallery having the beginnings of an international profile. We did a roundtable recently on Dwan and on the shows she'd done in New York, at her place in New York, with Benjamin Buclo and Alex Albaro, and a few people have thought about this a lot, for another forthcoming book on Dwan. But what came up is this, I mean, Benjamin Buclo is very categorical in his views, and he's like, how could you show Klein and Reinhardt? You know, it's impossible. And the same sort of wonderful question, at a certain moment in the 60s, you had to choose between Malevich and Duchamp or the Black Square and the Ready-Made, right? So there are these beautiful polaric events that happen right here, you know. So this would be something that we'll talk about today, and we did talk about a lot in that roundtable. But the Reinhardt show actually made it a reality, and of course Virginia's answer to Buclo was, I didn't plan them back to back like that. You know, it took her 2 years to get Reinhardt because he was beautifully resistant and misanthropic and all the rest of it. So, and she adored his incredible dignity and integrity, so that took a long time. It's not as if she sat there and said, I think I'll just do a Klein and a Reinhardt show, you know. So nonetheless, we're dealing with this now historically, and what are those ends of painting? What is that end of painting sort of moment? And I had this picture, oops, wrong way. So I had this picture of Klein making his painting with a spray gun on the left and this incredibly meticulous, beautiful surface of Reinhardt. So there's, you know, in comparison with which Klein looks absolutely vulgar, you know, like a car spraying or, you know, something like that. So anyway, these are sort of this volatile situation that we get. Now, I'm starting to run over time, so instead of reading you everything, I'm going to talk a little bit about the remainder of my slides, I think. So with the Reinhardt show, she did two Reinhardt shows. This first one was discussed a little bit yesterday, but James mentioned this, you know, image high up, the painting high up. It's a very odd decision to make. From the perspective of my talk, I'm sort of thinking about what taught her in LA with this test space of the first gallery, what she needed to do, what she needed to change, those kind of things. So if you look at this Reinhardt, it's pretty tight already in the space. This is either a brilliant idea or a funny idea to put this high up, but it's sort of like really working things out. How can you, and I think in Reinhardt's case, making all these black monochromes, which I called black polychromes, different by the different size, and putting one high and one low is a very beautiful, important pedagogical, you know, moment. If you did a very neat Castelli-style thing, you might not get Reinhardt's point about the difference of these paintings. And you'll see that the cushions have gone off the bench and they're looking very clean and beautiful now. So after Reinhardt was Rauschenberg. And again, we could say many things about this sort of end of abstract expressionist Duchampian moment, but on the level of pure practicality at the gallery, look at this. I mean, it's like they jammed in with a jimmy, you know, into the gallery. I mean, the small gallery just couldn't take the incredible gestures as they were growing of these artists, right? So this was one of the last, you know, the shows in this space started to sort of wrap up. Like Duan, obviously, she gave to Armand the downstairs space as a studio when he was working on his show that will be in the next space. But this was sort of towards the end of this gallery. Now, one other thing that comes very newly here, if you've looked at all these painting shows, Rauschenberg's Black Market requires participation. So there's this, there's four items in the case. There are stamps. The visitor comes up. They choose something. They replace it. And they write what they've done on these clipboards on the painting, stamping it 1 to 4. Now, I have a longer theory of where Rauschenberg got this from, but if you think about, I hope this is a segue into Alex's talk in a certain way, because somehow the Kienholz connection, Kienholz's suitcase that he gives Yves Klein, and Kienholz's absolutely aberrant, the one conceptual work, the conceptual tableau, you're thinking, where does that come from? But here's instructions, and, you know, so there's all these ways in which when we look at the record of the Duan Gallery, we see how the artists that we could have never imagined together are somehow, you know, Kienholz would have seen this show. He would have seen the suitcase, writing things down, the instructions, all that. And then, of course, the big mediator for Kienholz is Tingley. And Tingley had a show with stamps. He said, this is by John Tingley, and collaborating with the audience and all that. So these things were not, you know, conceptual art hadn't arrived, and you know, Kienholz's concept tableau is miles ahead of that, but it's always, you know, you can fill it in if you look at the Duan history. The first landing jump by Rauschenberg was also, you know, I think a very interesting touchstone of this moment. And I just want to quickly read you Donald Judd's review of this, like commentary on this, when it comes back to New York. And I want you to think about what it says about this legacy of sort of the monochrome that I've been loosely sketching. So first landing jump has a tire sitting on the floor. Judd had this, as James has very well proved, this very funny review style. Tire sitting on the floor, slightly overlapping the canvas. A black and white striped barrier runs down the canvas and through the barrier, slightly overlapping the canvas. The top half of the canvas is black tarpaulin. The bottom is linen, an area of white, and an area of white parallel to the barrier. There is a white metal lampshade in the top half. So it goes on with this sort of listing routine. The lampshade and the tire are polar forms, in part simply opposite to one another and in part complexly offset. I don't know if I can be bothered. Like, I was going to do a whole job performance, but it seems a bit silly. So the one point that he makes, which is what I wanted to get to, is that these ripples in the top of the canvas do something to the black of the Reinhardt that is in the direction of the ready-made. And then what I would put as my, if I had to do a sort of trajectory, the third slide for me would be Oldenburg's Good Humor Bar upside down with the ripply vinyl, you know. So Oldenburg says, yeah, I'm being expressive. This is expressive, right? But it's ready-made expression, right? It's industrial scale LA expression. So The very first cover of Art Forum, I actually asked the current editor if she knew what it was, and she had to do a lot of thinking because it's such an odd cover. But this happens right when Dwan opens her second gallery. The first cover of Art Forum was a shadow of a Jean Tanguy. And Tanguy wasn't represented by Dwan at this time. It was a review in that magazine of the Everett Ellen show when Dwan had Rauschenberg and Ferris had Kinholz. This is just to have a quick look at the Art Forum ads and how they sort of develop. This is sort of an indication of what these magazines used to look like, this sort of dorky on the left, like, you know, a Christmas sale kind of thing on the first image on the left and this Dwan ad on the right, and then a show of sculptors, the race. And then up the top, I thought this was sort of amazing. So Ferris Gallery is doing a Cornell show, and this strange Dwan ad says, you know, by the time you see this ad, this will be over and Christmas will be here and all this. And it's very, you know, proto-conceptual art in its format and very funny in its non-commercialism. So anyway, the progress of ads. The other thing of sort of like I did the... maybe the sort of Reinhold, Rauschenberg, Oldenburg, you know, monochrome story. Rauschenberg also was collaborating with Tingley and all these artists at this time. So there was a show in Amsterdam where Rauschenberg put his section in the show. And, you know, we don't want to draw the lines of influence too directly because it's boring, but, you know, there's definitely cross-pollination and sort of a fascinating dialogue going along between all these artists, which is very rarely acknowledged. So Tingley has his show. I'm just going to go really fast. Race. Dwan has this beautiful story when she does the interview with the Archives of American Art and says Marcel wanted cliched color, neon colors, right? So she went round with him to buy the neons and they had to be cliched. Race was desperately sort of competing with, I guess, Warhol and the pop thing in America. But what was beautiful about Dwan representing him and how she did it is, as you see by the ad on the left, it was sort of sexy in French. It wasn't American pop at all. It had this, you know, very different, pardon the pun, accent. And this is the studio that, you know, Race work in the studio. I'm nearly done. Another classic Art Forum, the Duchamp network of stoppages on the cover and the beautiful black square that is the ad for the square show of Reinhardt, the last show in the new space, his last show in her new space. We're going to leave this to the discussion, I think. This is sort of a mysterious thing I wanted to identify. This is a Robert Morris photograph of the same box inside the box for the boxes show. So getting to that tautology level. And I just close with the idea that, you know, minimalism and pop have always been, well, for a long time have been discussed as sort of these dramatic opposites in this same period in the 60s. But somehow, if we look at Oldenburg coming to LA, with his sort of seeing LA as industrial enormousness and Race sort of delegating his neons to another fabricator, you get all these ideas of minimalism in people that are normally typically pop. And by the same token, in minimalist figures, you know, this exuberant colour of Grosvenor is sort of surprising. One of my favourite shows, Dwan, and I'm not going to comment any further, it's just, we don't have time, but anyway. So I'm going to leave it there, and hopefully we'll pick all up all these ends in discussion. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.